This is the Thanks for Sharing podcast, the podcast where we explore all things recovery, healing, and relationship.
Remember to subscribe and download episodes in the iTunes Store, the Google Play Store, or on the Podbean app.
You can find more Thanks for Sharing at www.thanksforsharingpodcast.com or on Facebook at facebook.com/healingpaths. That's paths with an S.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Thanks for Sharing podcast. I'm Jackie P.
I'm John T.
Today, we thought we are going to look at step one.
Yep.
And the way that we want to look at step one is we're sitting here surrounded by several big books from different fellowships. And we're going to look at what each, well, not each, because there's like over 300 fellowships.
And we only, like, we have several books here. We have, I'm counting 8 books here.
Okay. So,
and I don't know how many of the 300 fellowships have their own big book. So this is a small sliver, probably, of what all big books offer. But we wanted to look at that and kind of compare and contrast through different step ones.
So we're going to take the books that we've collected and that are sitting all around us, and we're going to read what they say about step one, and then just talk about, because I think, you know, sometimes for people in recovery, they get into their fellowship and hopefully they get to know the literature in their big book really well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think one of the problems sometimes is we don't share very well our big books. And sometimes there's little nuances, or, you know, the ACA fellowship may have it through a different angle that adds this piece so beautifully, right?
Yeah.
So well. And if we're not looking at the various big books, then we may not, you know, just one phrase or something kind of changes it or adds this piece that we're like, oh, I see that differently.
Well, and so much of long-term recovery and maintaining sobriety is learning how to be relational.
Uh-huh.
And being relational is not single-faceted.
Right.
There's a lot of different angles you have to be able to look through and understand. So which book do you want to start with?
Well, I would say let's start with the big book.
Okay.
Which would be AA.
So we've got our copy of the AA big book here, and
I would read these two.
Okay, the first two paragraphs.
Yeah.
So this is the, I'm not sure how these pages correlate with the big book.
I think
this is the little red book.
I think they're the same.
Okay. So this is page 30 of the big book, the beginning of chapter 3. I'm going to read the first two paragraphs. It says, most of us have been unwilling to admit that we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think that he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove that we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This was the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people presently may be has to be smashed. So I really like their, I think that one really captures the delusion,
uh-huh,
that we can be in when we're practicing our addiction, that there is nothing special about us. There is nothing different about us. We can see all these people who don't have problems with the same thing that we have problems with, and we can mistakenly think that we shouldn't either.
Right, right. And I think that's one of the first grief losses that people run up against, right? Where they're looking at other people saying, well, they can have a couple of drinks and then go about their day just fine.
Yeah.
And I want to do that too. But in this reading, you know, from those two paragraphs, it really sets the stage that says you have to recognize that bodily you are different. Like,
mm-hmm,
you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Other people may be able to, but you're not one of those.
One of the things I really appreciate about AA's approach to the steps is I think it gets very little into why we drink the way that we do.
Uh-huh.
And it more starts with that acknowledgement, I drink the way that I do. It's a problem, and this is what I need to do going forward.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of, I think of the stages of grief, the denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. And I think a lot of energy can be spent early in recovery grieving the fact that we're different.
Right.
And I think there can be great value in just recognizing I'm different, and because I'm different, this is how I need to go forward.
Mm-hmm. And staying out of the bargaining that says, well, maybe if I do this and this and this, I won't be different. AA just says, you're different.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, it's part of the first step to recognize that you are different.
Yeah. In the AA 12 and 12, the 12 steps and 12 traditions, they talk about that difference a little bit more. I'm on page 21 of the 12 and 12. Do you want to read this one,
sure,
the highlighted parts?
So this says, who cares to admit complete defeat? Practically no one, of course. Every natural instinct cries out against the idea of personal powerlessness. It is truly awful to admit that, glass in hand, we have warped our minds into such an obsession for destructive drinking that only an act of providence can remove it from us. We know that little good can come to any alcoholic who joins AA unless he has first accepted his devastating weakness and all its consequences. Until he so humbles himself, his sobriety, if any, will be precarious. Of real happiness, he will find none at all. Proved beyond doubt by an immense experience, this is one of the facts of AA life. The principle that we shall find no enduring strength until we first admit complete defeat is the main taproot from which our whole society has sprung and flowered.
I know that outside of 12-step fellowships, that idea of powerlessness and that idea of admitting complete defeat doesn't fly well with a lot of people.
No. I've talked to other colleagues who don't work in the addiction field, and they're almost offended at that idea of powerlessness,
yeah,
and that we would talk about that with clients, like almost we are shaming them.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it doesn't really go well outside of the recovery world.
Yeah. And there are some approaches to getting sober. I don't know if you'd call them fellowships, but systems to getting sober that are not 12-step based. And I was in my interview last week with Jeff, we were talking off the mic a little bit about some different approaches, and he was telling me about this Buddhism-based approach that he says is his favorite. We should have him back on and have him talk about that. But I think for the purposes of the steps and the way that the rest of the 12 steps are set up, it's pretty important that you grasp that powerlessness. It's I think it's one of the paradoxes of how the steps work, is when we admit powerlessness, then we can do something.
Right.
Until we admit that, we're just kind of spinning our wheels, trying out the same solutions to the same problems that never worked.
Which I have to say, even as a therapist, you know, I've been watching this with one particular client the last 2 weeks. It's really hard to watch.
Yeah.
Them continue to keep coming up with creative solutions only to have the same outcome.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, admitting powerlessness, and that is the paradox, admitting powerlessness begins to start to change things. It's,
yeah,
it starts to have some power.
I was talking with a client this morning who is finding himself slipping back into fantasy and opening some back doors in his recovery. So we started talking about shame today, or we continued a conversation on shame today. And I had this client go through different events that were hard for him over the last 2 weeks, and have him identify what that meant about himself, that he was going through that. And he listed, like, there was this list of, I'm a jerk, I'm selfish, I'm incompetent. And part of his big struggle this week has been, he's talked about being annoyed with his spouse, and then thinking of people that he's had emotional affairs with in the past. So he's doing some comparison, and we got to the end of the things that have been happening to him, and we had this list of the I'm selfish, I'm this, I'm that, I can't, whatever, all those negative beliefs. And I said, if you were to take out the I'ms and the I's here and put in your spouse's name, would this all be true for how you see your spouse right now? And this client said, yes. And I said, so what does that mean to you? And he said, I think I'm looking in a mirror when I see my spouse, and I don't know what's me, and I don't know what's her, but I do know that every criticism I have about her is a valid criticism about me. And we started talking about how early on in relationships, I think we want to find people who reflect the parts of us that we like the best,
mm-hmm.
or the best parts of us. I think as we go on in relationships, we need relationships that reflect the truth about us, not just what we like right. to see.
Right.
And that's something I've heard from a lot of clients that they can be surprised by when they walk into a 12-step fellowship for the first time, is they're seeing the truth reflected around them. And they can see, or before they go, they can have these concerns like, it's going to be full of weird, creepy people, like these people are out of control. And when they hear people start to share, it's uncommon that I don't hear somebody say, they were telling my story.
Yeah.
And I was in a room full of people who are me and who get what it's like to be me.
Uh-huh. Well, and I think it's one of those, I was talking with a client a couple weeks ago, and they were complaining about their 12-step group. And, you know, they were mentioning off kind of, this is what I need, and this is what I need, and this is what I need. And granted, I think here where we are, and as I talk to colleagues across the country, there's a lot of states that, you know, don't have maybe the big cities that don't have some solid 12-step groups.
Yeah.
However, and I said this to the client, you can't have, there is not a fantasy 12-step group.
Yeah.
Where, you know, and we talk about this particularly in the S fellowships, where there's this idea of a cosmic lover.
Yeah.
Right? This person who's going to be everything I need them to be. And they're going to be, you know, I'm going to feel so great about myself because this is my lover, and they're so amazing in every single thing that I will finally feel whole and healed, and I'll finally feel enough.
Their very presence makes everything okay.
Right. And that's a fantasy. That's that cosmic lover that is not, it doesn't exist. But many people can pursue that for a long time. And again, we can have that cosmic 12-step fantasy.
Yeah.
That this group is going to be everything I need it to be. And the reality is this group is made of human beings.
Yeah.
And there's going to be some annoying people, and there's going to be some people who, again, share their story. And at first thought, you thought, I have nothing in common with them. But when they start sharing their story, you start to look past what you saw as differences or what you saw as, I don't like them. And you started to hear the same story.
Yeah. And later on in the steps and the traditions, we start to talk about what to do when we see those differences, mm-hmm. and how to turn the mirror back onto ourselves and recognize what reflection of us is there. That talk of the cosmic lover, I want to share next from the Essanon. This is for the family members and spouses of sex addicts.
Uh-huh.
I want to share from their first step, because I think that cosmic lover, that cosmic group, or the perfect solution thing is something that a lot of people, whether they're in active addiction or living around active addiction, I think that's the mode that we start to get into to solve the problem.
Mm-hmm.
I just have to come up with a new plan, a new approach. Right. And that's what it talks about in this Essanon first step. This is on page 1 of the Essanon fellowship text, and it says, accepting our powerlessness is our first admission that we give up. This may feel defeating and very frightening at first. In the past, we depended on ourselves to get through every crisis or difficulty. We relied on our intellects, our theologies, our past experiences, and on new schemes and strategies we developed. We felt sure that each new strategy would work. And even when it didn't, we just bounced back with an even more self-sufficiency and determination to succeed the next time. Our natural impulses were to take over, to force the issue, to make changes. We perceived ourselves to be more competent than the sexaholic, and we felt sure that being strong was the answer. In Essanon, we came to realize that just as we did not cause the sexaholic's acting out, we cannot cure it either. We learn that it is not our responsibility to keep the sexaholic sexually sober. Instead, it is our job to manage our own lives, whether or not the sexaholic chooses sobriety. I kind of chuckle at that, bouncing back with a plan with even more self-sufficiency and determination mm-hmm. to succeed the next time. Because there's a lot of truth in that there
mm-hmm.
for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of addiction, this Essanon text, I think captures that a lot of addiction is the new plan, the next plan. I'll get it perfect this time. I'll get it right.
I was talking with a client this morning, and he's struggling with a lot of relapse lately, and and relapse in a lot of different areas, multiply addicted and so relapsing in a lot of areas. And I just said to him, like, I gotta say, in case no one else has said this to you, you know, I'm just gonna put it out there, and maybe other people have said it and that's fine, but in case nobody else has said this to you, I'm gonna say this to you. And I just said, this doesn't have to be the only way you live life.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's not even a good way to live life. But maybe you don't know that there's another way of living. And it's actually a pretty good way of living. So just in case nobody said that to you, and you are stuck in that delusion that this is how you live, and some months are better than others, but it always leads to this. Like, I just gotta say, there's a whole different life out there, and it's much better than this one.
Yeah. Like it talked about in that step, I think it's terrifying to drop what we know
mm-hmm.
for something that we don't. Even when we hear from people there's a better way of living,
yeah.
or we go to meetings and we see people who are living differently, I think a lot of times it's easy to blow out of recovery when we start to hear what it takes
right.
to get to where those sober and happy and satisfied people are.
Mm-hmm.
I've had clients say to me before, when we've been talking about emotional blockages and the ability to feel and express emotions, I've had people say to me before, I'm not going to be like that guy in my group that just blubbers over everything. So if that's what you want from me, like, just forget it. I'm not going there. And I think early on in recovery, we can get a lot of mistaken ideas about what it actually takes
right.
to get sober. Like, this person thought that being able to cry at the drop of a hat was the missing ingredient.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of boiling it down to, this is the one thing I need, or this is the one approach.
Yeah.
And it's really not. There's not just one approach.
Yep. Well, and that's how I like, we've mentioned this on here before, how in the big book of AA, it does get into, like, rocketing into the fourth dimension
right.
of existence, right? It's this, like, where, yes, it will be such a foreign way of living, like nothing you've really ever known before. And so to keep thinking, I'm just going to still do a little bit of this and still a little bit of this, and then I'll just add in that one piece that's missing. And it really does have to be different, a different way of living than you've known before.
Yeah, and I think that's where the power of these texts lies, is that most of these texts are written, I think all of these texts are written by people who have been in the fellowship, who have worked the program, who have gotten better. Like, this is collected wisdom,
mm-hmm.
not just one person writing all this.
Right.
And so as we start to fathom that there's this radically different way of living, and that what we have been doing and what we can think of on our own is not going to work, and it hasn't
mm-hmm.
worked. At the same time, we have built in kind of the experience, strength, and hope of other people.
Mm-hmm.
And we have some of those other guides, or some of those other fellows who have been through that and can help us through that journey. It's not
yeah.
something that we're taking on our own. And I think in any of these fellowships, they talk a lot. Is this?
This is SA that I've got.
Okay. Which one was, does SA have step zero?
Yes.
Okay. So we're going to talk about step zero in a minute. But I think that concept of going to the fellowship and showing up to meetings is huge, and underlies all the work that we do
yeah.
going forward.
So this is on page 61 of the essay white book, the part where it says the solution. It says, we saw that our problem was threefold, physical, emotional, and spiritual. Healing had to come about in all three. The crucial change in attitude began when we admitted we were powerless, that our habit had us whipped. We came to meetings and withdrew from our habit. For some, this meant no sex with themselves or others, including not getting into relationships. For others, it also meant drying out and not having sex with the spouse for a time to recover from lust. And then it talks about, it says this on the next page, page 63. There is an unwritten step underlying all 12. Call it step zero. We participated in the fellowship of the program. No one seems able to stay sober and progress in recovery without it, though some try. For most of us, without associating in some way with other recovering individuals, there is no lasting sobriety, and none on the fringe benefits of recovery, growth, freedom, and joy. This holds true even for loners, those without groups. We don't try to explain this. It is simply a fact.
I love how clearly they talk about disconnecting from our addiction and connecting with the fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that I think is, if it's not clear in every text, it's certainly strongly implied in every text. But that's a really direct look at that process. We have to connect to others if we're going to disconnect from addiction.
Yeah. Okay, let's look at SAA, Sex Addicts Anonymous. And then this one, this is on page 22 of the Green Book. And it says, in taking the first step, we admit that our addiction is destroying us and that we are unable to stop it. Let me see if that's where I wanted to start. No.
It's good stuff.
It is. Let me back up to the under step one, the first paragraph. So it says, in our addiction, we held on to the belief that we were in control of our sexual behavior and could successfully manage our lives. This kept many of us from seeing that we even had a problem. We told ourselves that if we had tried harder, we could have stopped. But our experience has shown otherwise. No matter how many promises or resolutions we made, no matter how strong our efforts and our determination, the behaviors eventually returned, along with their painful consequences. Only when we admit our powerlessness over these behaviors and our inability to manage our own lives are we able to begin walking a path of recovery. In taking the first step, we admit that our addiction is destroying us and that we are unable to stop it. We surrender, raise the white flag, and accept that the battle is over. The principle behind this admission is honesty. For many of us, the first crack in our denial comes with hitting bottom and the despair of facing an unbearable situation. The next breakthrough occurs when we are honest enough to take the first step, acknowledging that we are powerless over the behavior that brought us to this point and that our lives are in shambles. We make this admission without excuses or rationalizations. With the first step, we stop lying to ourselves.
I like that part about facing the unbearable situation. Mm-hmm. I think I've said this before on the podcast, but I'll say to clients as they get sober, as you start to get sober, you're going to realize the reasons why you weren't sober before.
Mm-hmm.
Those emotions that you were running from, the situations you were running from, the relationships that weren't working, that will become painfully obvious.
Right.
And I think that can be a really difficult part about working step one, is admitting the powerlessness can sometimes feel worse than the way that we were living before. There's so much of the problem that we're now starting to define and starting to see. Whereas before, there was kind of some blissful ignorance or some maybe some benefit in not looking so closely at our lives.
Well, and I like how this talks about, you know, that we acknowledge the powerlessness that brought us to this point. So the first half of step one is the powerlessness. But the second half really is the unmanageability. And that's where it then says, and that our lives are in shambles, mm-hmm. right? That we make this admission without excuses or rationalizations. And with the first step, we stop lying to ourselves. And the others talk about this too, that we're going to bounce back with a new creative idea or, you know, a new piece that we're going to add to this. And the second step starts to really look at that unmanageability, mm-hmm. right? And when we understand unmanageability, we start to recognize that there's not this magic formula that's going to help us do all of this.
Yeah.
Making these choices, engaging in these behaviors, whether it be, you know, drugs, alcohol, sex, gambling. We're going to read a little bit from Debtors Anonymous. We're going to look at the stuff from the ACA and looking at the dysfunctional relationships. We start to recognize that we can't manage this. This is bigger than us. And that's when we start to really see the shambles of our life.
Mm-hmm.
And we stop lying about how messy everything is.
Yeah. It reminds me of my first attempts at keeping a budget in adulthood. Mm. I could not use those automated budget things like the websites you'd log into and link all your bank accounts, and then you just have to label what comes in.
Uh-huh.
Because if I didn't want to acknowledge that I spent money on something that wasn't in the budget, I just wouldn't categorize it, so it wouldn't show up.
The app only works if you put it all in, right?
Right. Right. But I think there's a lot. I think that can be a natural way to live life when the reality is overwhelming and the uh-huh. reality is scaring. Or scary. Patrick Carnes will talk about keeping a separate set of books.
Yeah.
And we have this way. I think that's how denial works. I'll look at what I want to, and I won't what I don't mm-hmm. want to. I won't even acknowledge that it's part of the equation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in step one, as we're admitting that we're powerlessness and our life is in shambles, we're actually keeping accurate books for the first time.
Yeah.
And recognizing the predicament that we're in.
I remember, you know, when I was first working in this field, and I was working with a teenager, she was like 17, and she definitely had an alcohol addiction going on. And I'd asked her to do a first step, and she did a first step, and she came in and was reading it to me. And listening to her first step, I'm like, why would you ever stop drinking? This is fabulous.
Right.
Like, everyone loves you. You are the life of the party. You have the most fun ever. You're included in all of the social functions. You know, and I just said, I want to hear the times when you woke up the next morning and you didn't know where you were.
Yeah.
I want to hear the times when you woke up and you had throw up in your hair and you didn't know if it was your vomit or somebody else's. Like, where is that? Because reading this, why would I even want you to quit?
Right.
And I mean, and she came back probably, I mean, we kept working, but probably a month later, she had the other part of her first step. And it was sad and
yeah.
it was heavy. And, you know, but we can do that. We can look how great it is. Like, I went to this party and I was great and everybody loved me.
It was so fun.
Yeah. But when we start to add in those other pieces, the sad pieces, the unmanageability, the powerlessness, yeah, there's a reason we need to quit.
Well, and that's a huge interruption to the cycle, because I think, you know, despair is a part of the addiction cycle, but I think we bypass the despair and active addiction
mm-hmm.
by getting into the next preoccupation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you can wake up with vomit in your hair and not know if it's yours and not know where you're at, but as long as there's a party that night, you don't have to worry
yep.
about it.
Yep. So Debtors Anonymous, we're just going to read a little bit about their step one. And it doesn't, Debtors Anonymous has a lot of stories that you'll be able to get into and probably relate to, but they don't have a whole lot of writing just about the step. So in their step one, it says, we recommend beginning with step one. It's always a good place to start, right?
Yes.
The sense of despair or hitting bottom we felt when we first came to DA was the first step in our recovery. So they're acknowledging, you know, that you hit step one sometime before you showed up to that meeting.
Mm-hmm.
We saw that our own attempts to scheme and manipulate our debts did not work. We admitted that we were powerless over debt, and we were ready to ask for help.
I like scheme and manipulate mm-hmm. are really powerful words.
Those
there.
Are two words that we haven't seen yet in talking about
yeah.
step one.
Which is so applicable to any fellowship that we've read
yep.
already. You know, with different addictions, I do think there are some different nuances in like the personalities that present and the kinds of manipulation
mm-hmm.
that we see, but I think that scheme and manipulate is beneath all of them.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's very overt and in your face, and sometimes it's very subtle.
Right.
But that's what we're doing. We're playing God and altering our reality.
Well, and sometimes we may have worked our step one over powerlessness and unmanageability, and then we read in DA and we hear these words scheme and manipulate, and you're like, oh, I missed stuff.
Right.
Oh, I got all the powerless and unmanageability, but now I got to go back and look at scheme and manipulate.
Yeah. Well, and this image just came to mind. I think a lot of people want the steps to be like this stairwell out
mm-hmm.
of hell.
Mm.
I don't know that the steps necessarily elevate us out of the muck and the mire that we're in. I think the steps are more linear, like they don't elevate us above. I think they help us to work through
mm-hmm.
And we even come back. I mean, they're tools, they're competencies that we're developing, not
right.
things on a checklist. So the ability to slice our behavior and go from powerless and unmanageability to now let me look at how I scheme and manipulate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a different skill set, which is really important to develop.
Right, right.
And we could probably come up with a lot of other pairs of words, powerless, unmanageability, scheme and manipulate, a lot of other pairs of words that are things that we need to look at in that spirit
mm-hmm.
of step one.
Mm-hmm.
So we're gonna end this episode with the ACA Fellowship. This is probably the big book that I'm most familiar with. And something interesting with ACA history. So ACA was formed as kind of a breakoff from Al-Anon.
Yep.
And there were people going to Al-Anon groups who were saying, I don't currently live with an addict, and I'm relating to a lot here, but I think there's a special set of experience,
uh-huh.
or there's a different experience having grown up with an alcoholic
right.
and then leaving. So Tony A is the founder of ACA, and he wrote his original steps. I don't have a copy of them in front of me here, but Tony A's original steps, like when you did step four, you took a blameless inventory of your parents.
Mm.
And a lot of it was focused on understanding the family story.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember when it was that the fellowship decided to adopt a different set of 12 steps as their official 12 steps that were focused on the individual.
So I heard Claudia Black, who also helped write the ACA Big Book, and I heard her talking about this process, and she was saying, again, kind of talking about these people who were showing up to Al-Anon who didn't even have somebody they could, like, put a finger on, like, this person in my life was the alcoholic. And sometimes you had to go back a generation or maybe two generations
yeah.
to actually find the addiction.
Yeah.
But they were showing up at the meetings and they were like, I don't even know that I know an alcoholic, but wow, this stuff really relates to me.
Yeah.
I'm so resonating. And what you're describing is so familiar to me, but I don't even know that I know an alcoholic.
Yeah.
And she, I think she used the number, I think if I'm remembering correctly, she said they were starting to see about a third of the people at the Al-Anon meetings who didn't have an identified alcoholic, but really resonated with the description and what they were talking about. And so that's when Al-Anon kind of went through an identity crisis.
Yeah.
And was saying, well, what are we going to do? You know, because our fellowship is for people who are living with an alcoholic, you know, children of alcoholics or spouses of alcoholics. And because they had Alateen too.
Uh-huh.
And so I guess there was a vote, if I'm remembering Claudia's story well, and they came back and said, no, like, you have to have an identified alcoholic that you're working the steps around. And so that's when Tony and some others left and ACA began to form. And they started saying, okay, we'll work with adult children of alcoholics, and then they added and other dysfunctions.
Yeah.
So, and what they started to recognize was that for these folks who didn't grow up with an alcoholic, you know, maybe grandpa was the alcoholic, but they didn't know grandpa, or great grandpa was the alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
And then his dad decided, wow, that was a horrible childhood for me. I don't want to do that. And so he never drank,
mm-hmm.
but the behaviors he still grew up with. You know, he had grown up in an alcoholic home and he didn't know how to do relationships differently. He didn't know how to do life differently other than not drink. So he wasn't drinking, but all of the other descriptors of that family would be the same.
Yeah.
And he passed that on to his kids and his kids passed that on to them. And they started to see that for a couple of generations, maybe the addiction disappeared, but it would always manifest again because the environment was still an addictive environment.
Well, and that's really what I think the ACA steps focus on, is divorcing from that toxic environment
yep.
or the toxic
yeah.
relationships. And actually, a lot of the ACA step one, like, there's genograms, there's
mm-hmm.
Talking about your role in the family. Like, there's a lot of that look
mm-hmm.
at kind of the culture, the environment that you came from.
Well, and the laundry list itself. I mean, when I am working with clients, you know, and they're in a AA fellowship or a SA fellowship or SAA, whatever it is, and they've been getting success in that fellowship, and I pull out the laundry list, I mean, the overwhelming response, and it's pretty much some version of, oh, shit.
Yeah. Yep.
That it's just like, I'm doing all of that. I don't know how to not do that, right? And it opens up this door for a whole new set of recovery, which is not as overwhelming as it sounds when I just said that. And it really begins to say, I don't have to live that way.
Yeah. And this is what step one starts to talk about. So I'm going to read a couple selections. I'm on page 123 of the Big Red Book. Many times adult children struggle in their ACA program because they cannot seem to break ties with destructive or manipulative relatives. We cannot grow and find our true inner selves as long as we engage in family dysfunction that is draining and unhealthy. Separating from our dysfunctional family is a healthy act of defiance. By doing so, we are challenging the authority of the family lie. We are making a statement that we will no longer be loyal to denial or dysfunctional family roles. This can seem frightening, but we have the support of our ACA group. And then on the next page, 124, it says, all bottoms have meaning. All bottoms can be a starting point for a new way of life. There is hope. Healing is possible. Surrender means becoming willing to do whatever it takes to recover and find peace in surrendering our lives. We admit complete defeat, and we give up notions that we can fix or control someone else. We become willing to attend meetings, work the 12 steps, and break through the denial of family dysfunction. Amazingly, an estimated 50% of adult children of alcoholics deny or cannot recognize alcoholism in their families. By growing up in a dysfunctional home, we became desensitized to the effects of alcoholism, abusive behavior, and lack of trust. Recovery from the effects of an alcoholic or dysfunctional upbringing process, or a dysfunctional upbringing, is a process, not an event. You know, like we were looking at in Currency of Hope, the Debtors Anonymous, it made it sound like we reach step one before we go to the first meeting.
Mm-hmm.
I think for a lot of people going to ACA, step one is a process they come to through about the first six consecutive meetings
mm-hmm.
that they go to. There's a lot of, as you hear the stories, as you read on your own, as you start to connect, you start to see the picture that you were
mm-hmm.
desensitized and accustomed to.
Yeah.
And I think that highlights another part of step one that we've seen a lot in these other fellowship books, is there's this awakening process. And I think for some people it's a gradual awakening.
Uh-huh.
For some people it's very abrupt.
Right. Like, it's a startle.
Like waking up from a nightmare.
Yeah.
Saying I can never go back there.
So just also share, because ACA has their own version of the Serenity Prayer too.
Yeah.
So share that.
Yeah, so the ACA Serenity Prayer says, God grant me the serenity to accept the people I cannot change, the courage to change the one I can, and the wisdom to know that that one is me.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
I love that because I think, you know, we've got to start where we are. And we talk about how oftentimes getting into recovery is kind of like a whack-a-mole because most addicts have multiple addictions. And,
yep.
And so we start with the biggest, and we work from there. But most often in our recovery, we'll always, I think every addict needs to land in the ACA.
Mm-hmm.
Or in, you know, you may be an alcoholic and at some point you start attending the Al-Anon.
Yeah.
Because your addiction didn't happen in a vacuum.
Yeah.
And as we start to recognize where those relationships impacted us and became, you know, the garden for our addiction to grow in. And then we start to recognize again that I love that the wisdom to know that that person that I can change is me.
Mm-hmm.
And that transforms our life. We start to live a different life.
Yeah. I think we get our power aligned when we start to realize that there's one person that we
mm-hmm.
can change.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a good place to leave off for
yeah.
today's episode. Again, we want to put a call out. We want to do a Q&A episode, so we're still looking for questions from our listeners. So you can submit those through our website, thanksforsharingpodcast.com. Or you can email those to us at thanksforsharingpodcast@gmail.com. So I want you to remember that your story matters. Remember, there's something meaningful in every chapter. Don't wait to share your story until it's finished.
You can share your story with us on our Facebook page, Healing Paths, Inc., or on our website, www.thanksforsharingpodcast.com.
Thanks.
This podcast is solely for the purpose of information and entertainment and does not constitute therapy, nor should it replace competent professional help.
At the end of another episode, we want to remind you that nobody has time for perfection. We are pursuing progress.
And remember the prayer of the perfectionist. Help me remember I can't do it all. Help me to take things one step at a time, and that the only step I need to focus on is the next right step for me.
Help me to remember that life is a journey. Help me to be able to separate all that I am learning from all that I have to do. Help me to remember that I am not alone, that I can ask for help. Help me to strive for frequent awakenings, not mastery. I am enough. Amen.